Good morning, everybody. My name is Doug Grant, General Manager of the American Chamber of Commerce. I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal people, who are traditional custodians of this land. I'd like to pay my respects to the elders, past, present, and future. I'd also like to extend that respect to any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islanders who join us here or online today. I'd like to welcome those who've joined us in person and also thank those who've joined us online. And I'd also like to thank ANZ Bank for hosting this very special briefing. Good morning to our guest speaker, Mr. Lowe, Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia, and to those who've also dialed in via the audio link supplied by the Reserve Bank. In a moment, I'll invite Mr. Lowe to the podium, and following his speech, we'll accept questions from the audience with moderator Nadine Blaney from AusBiz TV, Head of Content. Please welcome Mr. Philip Lowe.
Thank you, Doug, and good morning, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here at another AmCham event. Thank you for the invitation, and Richard, thank you to ANZ for hosting us here today. As we're all aware, it's a very challenging time in the global economy. Most countries, including the United States and Australia, are experiencing the highest rates of inflation that they have in many years, and the tragic events in Ukraine have led to sharp increases in the prices of energy and prices of food right around the world. Interest rates are also increasing everywhere from the record lows that we saw during the pandemic. All this is happening at a time when unemployment rates in many countries are very low and household budgets are under strain in most countries as well. So it's a really complex policy environment at the moment. Today, I would like to begin by focusing on the recent inflation data and the outlook for inflation in Australia. I'll then turn to how monetary policy is responding to this higher inflation. And I'd also like to share with you some of the observations from the Reserve Bank Board's recent review of the yield target, which we published at 8 o'clock this morning. This review is one review in a broader set of reviews the Board is undertaking regarding our pandemic response. We want to be open, and we want to be transparent, and we want to learn lessons for the future, and I'd like to share some of the observations from that review with you this morning. But before I do that, first to inflation. The rise in inflation is a global story, and you can see this in my first chart. In the US and in Europe, inflation is above 8%, and in some countries, the peak in inflation has not yet been reached. I think in the United Kingdom we're expecting double-digit inflation before the end of the year. Inflation's also picked up in Asia, although it isn't as high as it is in the North Atlantic. As you can see in this chart, Japan's a notable standout. While inflation has picked up in Japan, it's still only just above 2%. But almost everywhere inflation is at multi-year highs. Australia is no exception to this trend, as you can see, although inflation here remains below that in most other advanced economies. In headline terms, inflation was in Australia was 5.1% in the year to March. As you can see, that's the highest rate in many years. In underlying terms, inflation was 3.7%. That's higher than it's been for some time, although it's still lower than it was at the peak of the resources boom. But in both headline and underlying terms, inflation is much higher than we had earlier expected, and it's much higher than central banks around the world had expected. The fact that inflation is high everywhere tells us that there are some powerful global forces at work. During the pandemic, supply chains were interrupted, delivery times blew out, and firms' cost of production increased. Not surprisingly, we're seeing higher prices. And then on top of the pandemic-related problems, Russia's invasion of Ukraine has caused major disruptions to the global markets for energy and food. And as a result, oil prices have increased by a lot, 28% since February. And global food prices, you can see in this chart, have increased very sharply. There's also been very strong growth globally in demand. During the pandemic, central banks and the fiscal authorities put in place very stimulatory policies. So you've seen stimulatory monetary and fiscal policy, which has resulted in strong demand globally at a time of an impaired supply side and prices being pushed up because of the war in Ukraine. So these are powerful global forces. When events like these occur, it isn't possible for us in Australia to insulate ourselves from their effects. We live in an interconnected world, and big shocks in global markets will affect and do affect our markets, and they affect the prices that we pay for goods and services here in Australia. As you can see in this next chart, petrol prices in Australia are up 37% over the past year. That alone is adding 1% or a bit more to the headline inflation rate. So 37% rise in petrol prices, and that's due to global developments. Another example where the disruptions in global markets is evident on prices we're paying here in Australia is the prices of new cars, which you can see here are rising at the fastest rate in many years. And there are many other examples as well where goods that are produced in global markets, their prices are going up very quickly, and it's inevitable that those higher prices flow through to higher prices here in Australia. But as important as these global influences are, they don't provide a full explanation for the higher inflation in Australia. Increasingly, domestic factors are also playing a role. Following the strong recovery in demand from the pandemic, growth in domestic spending is testing the ability of the economy to produce goods and services. This is particularly evident in the labour market, with many firms reporting that the availability of labour is a significant strain on their ability to operate and to expand and invest. And you can see the results from one of the surveys in this graph here. It's, every business meeting we have at the moment, firms are telling us that it's hard to find workers with the right skills. Many parts of the construction sector are also operating at close or at full capacity, and we've seen some public infrastructure investment being delayed or scaled back because of capacity constraints, either in terms of workers or the availability of resources. So increasingly across the Australian economy, we're seeing evidence of capacity constraints. Not surprisingly, this pressure on capacity has led to a broadening of inflation pressures in Australia, and this is evident in this next chart, which shows the share of the items in the CPI basket with annualised price increases more than 3%. As you can see, that share is the highest it's been in many years. In fact, it's the highest since 1990. So a lot of the elements of the consumer price basket are increasing at relatively fast rates. We've seen a broadening of inflation pressures, and I think that's likely to continue for a while yet. When the RBA published its latest set of forecasts in May, we expected that inflation would peak at the end of the year at around 6%. The information that we've had available since then has led us to push that forecast peak in inflation higher. Since early May, petrol prices have risen further due to global developments, and the outlooks for retail prices of electricity and gas have been pushed higher due to the well-known pressures on capacity in that sector. And as a result, we're now expecting the inflation to peak at 7% in the December quarter. 7% in the December quarter. Following this, by early next year, we expect that inflation will begin to decline. And I'd like to share with you three factors that lie behind our assessment that inflation will decline next year. The first is that some of the pandemic-related supply-side problems in the global economy are gradually being resolved. See this in this chart. Firms have been adjusting to their new operating environment, and they have been solving the problems in global production and logistic networks. As a result, delivery times have shortened a little from late last year. The prices of semiconductors have declined. They're still very high, but they have declined. And the global production of cars, which has been impaired over the past couple of years, is now showing signs of a recovery. So the global production and distribution system is adjusting. As that adjustment continues, we'd expect some of the inflation pressures, particularly in goods, to ease. It's still possible we have further setbacks because of COVID, but the global production system is adjusting, and that's going to help. The second factor is a more technical one, but it's one that's important that we don't lose sight of. It's important to remember that inflation is the rate of change in prices. It's not a concept about the level of prices. This means that for inflation to stay high, prices have to keep increasing at an elevated rate. If prices simply remain high, then the rate of inflation declines. An example of this is oil prices. Even if they were to stay at their current elevated level, the rate of inflation in oil prices over the past year was 66%. So oil prices up 66%. If they stay at their high level, then the rate of inflation in oil prices goes to zero. That mightn't be of much comfort to people who are struggling with the current high level of petrol at the bowser, but it would mean that the measured rate of inflation would go from, what I said, petrol prices up 37% over last year to something closer to zero. So it's a technical factor, but it's one that we shouldn't lose sight of. Inflation is about the rate of change of prices, not the level of prices. But the third factor that will bring inflation down is the tightening of monetary policy right around the world, including here in Australia. The higher interest rates will help create a more sustainable balance between demand for goods and services and the ability of our economies to produce those goods and services. Achieving that balance between demand and supply isn't going to be straightforward, and there are risks involved. But the higher interest rates will help alleviate some of the inflation pressures we're experiencing globally and here in Australia. So this brings me to the Reserve Bank's board decisions over the past couple of months. In May, as you know, the board increased the cash rate target by 25 basis points, and in June it increased the target by a further 50 basis points. As you can see in this chart, these increases were the first increases in quite a long time. The last time the cash rate was increased was 2010. Over its recent meetings, the board judged that given the inflation data and the outlook that I've just discussed, it was no longer appropriate for interest rates in Australia to remain at the COVID emergency levels. The increase in the cash rate in May followed the higher than expected CPI inflation outcome for the March quarter, and the evidence from business surveys and our own business liaison that growth in labour costs had picked up, and the pickup was likely to continue given the tightness in the labour market that I spoke about before. In June, we decided to make a bigger 50 basis point adjustment on the basis of the additional information suggesting a further upward revision to the inflation forecast from an already high forecast. And the board, at its recent meeting, also gave consideration to the fact that the level of interest rates in absolute terms was still very low, particularly for an economy that's got a strong labour market and a high level of inflation. The board of the Reserve Bank is committed to doing what's necessary to ensure that inflation returns to the 2-3% target over time. High inflation damages the economy. It reduces the purchasing power of people's incomes and devalues people's savings. It's also regressive. It hurts most those who are least well-equipped to deal with the high inflation. So it is important that we chart our way back to an inflation rate in the 2-3% range. We don't need to, nor can we, get there immediately. Australia has long had a flexible medium-term inflation target, which by design can accommodate fluctuations in inflation around target. You know, for a number of years, inflation was below target, and now it's above target. What's important here is that we chart a credible path back to an inflation rate of 2-3%, and I'm sure we can do that. The path of getting inflation back to 2-3% will be easier to navigate if the inflation psychology in Australia does not shift too much. An important lesson from the 1970s is that if inflation shock shifts people's expectations about the ongoing rate of inflation, it becomes harder to get inflation back down again. If people's expectations shift persistently, then it's going to be harder to get inflation back down. Applying this lesson to today, it's important that the high rate of inflation this year does not feed through into ongoing inflation expectations. If it did, the period of higher inflation would persist and it would be more difficult and more costly to reverse. To date, medium-term inflation expectations have been well anchored around the 2 to 3% mark, suggesting that people believe that we will, over time, get back to target. And we want to do what we can to make sure that, this remains the case, that people continue to believe that inflation will come back to the 2 to 3% range. Higher interest rates have a role to play here by helping ensure that spending grows broadly in line with the economy's capacity to produce goods and services. And higher interest rates can also directly affect expectations by demonstrating the strong commitment of the RBA to return inflation to target. As we chart our way back to 2 to 3% inflation, Australians should be prepared for more interest rate increases. The level of interest rates is still very low for an economy with low unemployment and that's experiencing high inflation. I want to emphasise, though, that we're not on a preset path. How fast we increase interest rates and how far we need to go will be guided by the incoming data and by the board's assessments of the outlook for the inflation rate and for the labour market. As we make our assessment each month, the board will be paying close attention to developments in the global economy, to the evolution of domestic labour costs, and household spending is responding to the higher interest rate environment. The recent news on household spending has been broadly positive, with spending bouncing back following the Omicron setback. Household balance sheets are in generally good shape. Households have accumulated more than $200 billion in additional savings over the past 2 years. $200 billion, that's a lot of money. Furthermore, the current rate of saving out of income remains higher than it was before the pandemic. So there is a degree of flexibility in many household budgets. This is one area where Australia is different to many other countries, where the saving rate has returned to pre-pandemic levels. In Australia, Australians are still saving a higher rate of they're saving at a higher rate out of their current income than they were previously. So there is a buffer there. I think it's also relevant that there are strong job opportunities, there's strong demand for labour, number of job vacancies is very high and firms are wanting to hire people. So that's a positive environment. On the other side of the ledger, though, many households have not experienced a period of rising interest rates. As I said, the last time the Reserve Bank increased interest rates was back in 2010. So a lot of people have not had experience with higher rates. Many households are also experiencing a decline in their real income because their normal income isn't matching a pace with the high rate of inflation. In addition to that, housing prices are now declining in our major cities. So real incomes are going backwards, housing prices are declining, and people having to cope with higher interest rates. So that's a counterbalance to the positive position of household balance sheets. And given these various considerations, we'll be watching household spending very carefully as we chart our way back to 2 to 3% inflation. I'd now like to shift gear and turn to the review of the yield target, which the RBA released this morning. So first, some background. As part of its pandemic response in March 2020, the RBA implemented a target for the yield on the three-year Australian government bond. At the time, the target was 25 basis points. That target was part of a comprehensive package designed to lower funding costs in Australia and support the supply of credit, particularly to businesses. The board chose to directly target the yield on a three-year government bond rather than to implement a program of bond purchases. It judged that in the circumstances of the time, this was a more direct way of influencing the interest rates that matter most for the cost of finance in Australia. The yield target was lowered from 25 basis points to 10 basis points in November 2020, and the target was discontinued a year later in November 2021. For most of the time the target was in operation, the RBA didn't need to buy any bonds in the market to achieve the target, although there were a few episodes where we did need to purchase bonds, as you can see here. All up, the RBA purchased around $36 billion of three-year bonds to to support the target, but on most days we didn't need to transact in the market. The review published this morning discusses the main decision points and the lessons from this experience. It concludes that the yield target was successful in lowering funding costs and supporting the provision of credit in Australia. In doing this, it did help the economy recover from the pandemic. But these benefits did come with complications. If similar circumstances were to arise in the future, the board would likely make different choices, although it has not ruled out using a yield target again in some form. Given the yield target was part of a policy package, it's difficult to disentangle its specific contribution to the decline in interest rates from other elements of that package. But following the introduction of the target, lending rates fell considerably, especially fixed rates. You see this here. Banks lowered their interest rates on three-year fixed loans to well below the rate on variable loans. I think that was the first time we'd seen that. And the share of housing loans contracted at fixed rates rose to a record high. So these adjustments did help the housing market in Australia in a period of great uncertainty, and they also helped household finances during this difficult period. One particular feature of the yield target that the review draws attention to is it was construed as a form of time-based guidance. This interpretation was reinforced by the bank's communication that in the central scenario, policy interest rates were unlikely to be increased until 2024. This time-based element of our communication was helpful in the dark days of the pandemic. It sent a strong message that the RBA would do what was necessary to provide the support for the economy in a difficult time. But the yield target was not a flexible policy instrument as times changed. And it also created communication challenges, given that the board's decisions were in fact dependent upon the state of the economy, not on the calendar. So there were communications challenges associated with the yield target. As the health situation improved and the economy turned out to be much more resilient than expected, the yield target became a less effective policy instrument. Other market interest rates for a similar term moved away from the yield on the three-year government bond, and that limited the transmission of the target to the real economy. And this is in contrast to the first phase of the pandemic, when there was a close alignment between the target and market interest rates. The review also draws attention to the fact that the board maintained a very strong focus on its decision making on ensuring against the downside risks. It's important to remember that at the time the target was adopted, there were credible forecasts that tens of thousands of Australians would die in the next few months, that the demand for hospital beds in Australia would exceed our capacity, and that a vaccine would be years away. The unemployment rate was also expected to reach double-digit levels, perhaps 15%, and there were fears of a deep and long downturn, of scarring to the economy, and that a generation of Australians would have years of lost opportunity. So that was the environment in which we were making decisions back in the early part of 2020. As we look around now and the life's getting back to normal for most of us, it's easy to forget how dark those days were. In this environment, the board was very concerned about downside risk to the economy. It sought to provide insurance against these potentially very bad outcomes, and the yield target was part of that insurance policy. The board certainly recognised that things could turn out better than expected, but its priority at the time was guarding against the downside. This was on the basis that if the downside did prevail, the cost to our society and the cost to our economy would be very high, and there was little further scope for the bank to respond. On the other hand, if the worst outcomes were avoided and the upside prevailed, the policy could be adjusted, as it ultimately was. So we took out insurance, and you can have different views on whether the insurance was necessary or whether we took out too much. But our mindset at the time was providing insurance against what could have really been catastrophic outcomes, not only for the economy but for our society. The review discusses various decision points and the different decisions that we could have made at those points. I think with hindsight, it can be argued that there was too much focus on the downside risks to the economy and the need to insure against them, and that there was too little focus on the possibility that things could work out better than expected. But in the real time in which decisions had to be made under great uncertainty, the review notes that the focus on the downside risk was understandable and the yield target was part of that in downside insurance. The board recognises that opinions will differ as to whether it struck the right balance. As part of its review, the board has agreed to strengthen its scenario analysis in future decision making. It also recognises that the way the target ended in late 2020 was disorderly, and it did cause some reputational damage to the RBA. We accept that earlier communication from the bank could have eased the situation, although the end of a target that was losing credibility was always likely to be associated with some volatility in market prices. The board has not ruled out using a yield target again in extreme circumstances, but it views the probability of doing so as low. The use of a yield target in some form would need to be evaluated against other policy choices, including a bond purchase program. A bond purchase program does offer more flexibility, but it carries other risks. These include larger potential financial costs for the central bank and the possibility of reduced bond market functioning as central bank bond purchases increase. As we're seeing around the world now, there can also be challenges in unwinding a large bond purchase program. So it's more flexible, but it comes with other complications as well. To assist us with future policy choices and to learn lessons from our recent experience, the board will undertake a review of Australia's experience with the bond purchase program later this year. We're also going to undertake a review of our approach to forward guidance. Consistent with our commitment to transparency and to openness and accountability, these reviews will also be published in the second half of the year. Thank you very much for listening, and I'd be delighted to answer your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Philip Lowe, and welcome, and thank you to all in the room. We will be taking questions from both people in the room and those that are coming in virtually, as of course it's 2022. So let's start in the room though, just right here.
Good morning, Governor. Swati from Bloomberg News. You raised interest rates by 25 bips in May, followed that up by 50 bips in June. Can we expect 75 bips in July? Is there a need for a larger than 50 basis point increase? Is it on the table? And what are the likelihood of that? Thanks.
The minutes of the board meeting are coming out later this morning, and in that meeting, in those minutes, you'll see we discuss the possibility of a 25 basis point increase or a 50. And in the end, we decided on a 50 basis point increase because of the upward revision to the inflation outlook and the recognition that interest rates were still very, very low for an economy that was experiencing high inflation and had such low unemployment. I would expect that we would have the same discussion again at the next meeting. And we're not, as I said in my prepared remarks, we're not on a preset path. We're going to look at the data we have each month and the level of interest rates and the inflation outlook. But I expect that next month we'll be having the same discussion at our board meeting, 25 or 50. Well, no. that's your language. I'm saying, well, that's what we discussed last time, and we'll discuss that board meeting still a couple of weeks ago, so other things can happen. But at the moment, I think that will be the decision we'll be taking, either 25 or 50 again at the next meeting.
Thank you, Governor. I guess thank you from Australians in the first instance in terms of how you've communicated over the last couple of years. We really appreciate that. A bit of a double barrel question. You spoke about the tension between global and domestic factors around inflation. I'm curious as to what sort of conversations occur with other banks in terms of, I guess, a coordinated global response. Or is this purely a domestic play that you're looking at? And secondly, could it also be said that monetary policy is more potent these days, given balance sheets, given all the factors you just discussed?
Perhaps I'll take the kind of international question first. As tomorrow night I'm going to my second overseas trip this year back to Switzerland to have a meeting with the central bank governors to discuss this set of issues. When I was there in May, there were two broad streams of thought. One is that the high inflation is cutting into people's real incomes. We see this here, but in the United Kingdom it's particularly noticeable, isn't it, with their inflation is going to be above 10 and incomes may be rising at 4 or 5. So that's a cutting real income of 5 or 6%. Now, that really hurts people. And that's happening in many advanced economies at the moment. So some people are of the view that this cutting real income is going to crimp household spending, the economies will slow, perhaps unemployment will rise and inflation will come down fairly quickly. That's a pretty negative view of the world. The other view is that these supply-side problems in the global economy can resolve, and they are resolving, and that oil prices aren't going to keep going up at 66% a year, maybe stabilise, or let's hope they come down, and that will change the inflation dynamic, and that households, like in Australia, who've built up big buffers, will be able to smooth through this period of a hit to their real incomes, and that inflation can come down without the unemployment rate going up too much. So their views that people are talking about in the official community, when you hear people discuss them, they both seem plausible. And I think this is why markets are, one of the reasons why markets are volatile at the moment, because we're all having trouble working out which of those views is more likely to represent reality. And I'm sure when I go there this weekend, we'll be discussing the same set of issues. You asked whether, in the second part of the question, whether monetary policy is more potent now. I wouldn't say it's more potent, but I think it will be potent. Right at the start, the first increases in interest rates that we've done really haven't affected most people's mortgage payments that much, because people have built up big buffers. Many people were paying more than they needed to. So at the moment, the higher interest rates have not had a really first-order effect on most people's mortgage payments. That clearly have hurt some people, but broadly it hasn't had a big cash flow effect. But as interest rates start to rise, those buffers will be eaten into, and the fact that households have more debt than they used to, yeah, it will start to bite, and we're very conscious of that. When that point is, it's going to be hard to tell, because we've got more financial assets as well. Now, households, $200 billion of extra savings, that's a lot of money. So that's sitting in offset accounts and it's sitting in deposit accounts. So there are a lot of kind of moving pieces here, and that's why I drew attention in my prepared remarks, the fact that we'll be monitoring household spending very carefully. But where we stand today, household spending's been pretty resilient.
Richard Edward.
Governor Edward Boyd at Sky News. Look, it's looking likely that America will fall into recession next year. New Zealand's just recorded a quarter of negative GDP growth. It's pretty clear these economies seem to be a bit ahead of us. How likely is Australia going to fall for a recession? How likely is that?
Well, I don't see a recession on the horizon here. Right at the moment, the unemployment rate's the lowest in 50 years. The participation rate's the highest ever. More working age Australians have jobs than ever before. The number of job vacancies is at a record high. Households have strong balance sheets. Our terms of trade, so this is the price, our export prices, relative input prices, are at the highest ever. When we had the resources boom a decade ago, I used to say, well, it's the highest since 1848, when we had the gold rushes in in the British colonies. That was the highest since 1848. Yet here we are today in 2022 having, you know, higher terms of trade, which is really boosting our national income a lot. So Australia has a lot of positives, and so we don't see a recession on the horizon, but the last 2 years has taught us anything. We can't, you know, you can't rule anything out, but our fundamentals are strong and the position of the household sector is strong and firms are wanting to hire people at record rates. Doesn't feel like the precursor to a recession. And interest rates, while they've gone up, are still low. The cash rate is still less than 1% at a time when unemployment rates are at a 50-year low. So the fundamentals here are still pretty positive.
Governor Lowe, will the unemployment rate need to rise to really get that inflation rate back within the target band?
I don't think it needs to rise, but at some point it may rise. It's quite possible that inflation comes down because of the oil prices don't keep rising, that the supply-side problems get resolved, and we get a better balance between supply and demand in the economy. But it's a fairly narrow path we're on. We're trying to get demand and supply to increase at the same rate, and achieving that's difficult. So, you know, it's quite possible that at some point in time the unemployment rate will rise, but I don't think it needs to rise. I'm hoping we can get inflation back 2 to 3 and keep the unemployment rate roughly where it is.
That brings me to a question that's come in from online. This is from Ronald Mizzen. He said, you've updated your forecast for peak inflation over the past week, which you've discussed. What is your forecast now for when underlying inflation will return to that target band? So he's looking for a timeline.
It's a couple of years away. We have not yet done a full update of our forecasts following the May update. The new headline inflation forecasts were really done kind of mechanically from higher oil prices and higher electricity and gas prices. So in the next month or so, we'll be doing a full forecast update. But it's going to be some years, I think, before inflation's back in the 2 to 3% range. But it will, over the next couple of years, it will gradually come down, and that's what's important, that we chart this path back there and people have confidence that we'll do that.
Sarah Hunter, KPMG, if we could get a microphone.
Thank you, Governor Lowe. I wanted to ask you a bit more about, you know, talking about the balance of demand and supply and wanting to get the two to grow together in a low, stable inflation rate, and how you see the monetary policy settings and the path of the interest rate interacting with the fiscal policy settings, particularly thinking about some of the fiscal supports that are going to start to hit households from 1 July, whenever people start doing their tax returns.
Well, there'll be... I guess you're referring to the Lomito payments that people will get, which will help household spending. But I'm not concerned about any misalignment between monetary and fiscal policy here. I understand why the previous government, the current government, want to provide some support to households, particularly those most affected by the higher cost of living. So that's understandable. The higher interest rates, as I said in response to an earlier question, will slow some forms of spending. I think we need that because at the moment the growth in spending in the economy is putting too much pressure on the ability of the economy to produce goods and services. So higher interest rates are a part of the way of getting that better balance. How high we need to go, it's still to be determined. I don't have a crystal ball here, so you've got to both demand and supply side. So interest rates affect the demand side in a relatively predictable way, but the supply side, as we know, can be subject to big shocks. So how to get that balance right is our challenge, and it's a challenge. But I'm not worried about any misalignment of monetary and fiscal policy. The bigger challenge for us is getting demand to grow and growing the supply.
Next question, Tim.
Governor, thanks for the speech. You covered a lot of ground there. I just want to think about pre-COVID when interest rates were at 75 basis points. Fast forward to today, And we have a market pricing in 3.75 as a cash rate target, 4.25 early next year. I know you said there's no preset path, but you've spoken a few times about 2.5% as being a neutral level. To what extent do you think current market pricing reflects a reasonable trajectory for interest rates, or is it down to the reputational damage you think coming out of yield curve control might have done?
I don't think the current market pricing is a result of the way the yield target was managed. At the moment, current market pricing is for the cash rate to be 4% by the end of this year. To get to 4%, we would have to increase interest rates at 50 basis points at the remaining six meetings for this year, and have a 75 basis point increase in there as well. I'll leave it to others to opine on whether they think that's reasonable. I would observe that that would be the sharpest and quickest tightening of monetary policy that we've ever experienced in the inflation targeting regime. And I'll leave it to others to come to their judgment whether they think that's reasonable. An increase in interest rates of that magnitude, I think, would have a first-order effect on consumption, would affect people's mortgage payments, it would affect confidence. I think it would slow the economy quite a lot. So I don't think it's particularly likely, but the market has been a better judge of where interest rates are going than we have over the past few years, so got to pay attention.
Another question at the back of the room.
Governor, on the issue of household balance sheets and the ability to absorb interest rate increases, at the other end of the spectrum from those that have built up buffers, the April Financial Stability Review estimated that a 200 basis point rise in mortgage rates would see an increase in the share of borrowers facing high repayment burdens, being those with a debt service ratio of greater than 30%, rising from 10% to 20%. On that question of market pricing, 300 basis points from here, when we've already returned to a cash rate that's at pre-pandemic levels, is there a level at which the RBA would be concerned about borrowers with high repayment burdens that the board would be uncomfortable with? And is it reasonable to see this level increasing relatively rapidly?
As I said before, we'll be watching household spending very carefully, and we know that while the median borrower has built up big financial buffers, there are a group of borrowers who have very skinny buffers. People who've taken out their first housing loan in the last year or so, who've bought a bigger house in the past couple of years and borrowed as much as the bank could lend them. Those people have fairly skinny buffers. And we're very conscious of that, and we'll be watching that part of the loan distribution very carefully as we raise interest rates. There's no particular cutoff where it becomes a problem. We'll just be monitoring it very carefully, as we know that the averages can hide a lot of variation, and not everyone has built up these big buffers. But the median borrower has a buffer well, in excess of a year's mortgage payments, and some people have 2 years mortgage payments, but there are this tail of people who aren't in that position. So our job is to monitor the whole distribution and assess how it's going to affect overall consumption. But there's no critical point where it becomes an issue.
Hi, Governor. Daniel Sutton from Channel 10. Thank you for the speech. I've got a two-part question, if that's okay. Firstly, the Treasurer has indicated, we read, that he's going to move ahead with an independent panel review into the RBA. I wonder what your response to that is, and are you worried about what it might dig up? And the second part of the question is, it's a personal one. I wonder, you've been at the RBA a long time, but as Deputy Governor and Governor, this is the first time that interest rates are going up. But I wonder personally whether you worry about the misery that the decisions the RBA takes may end up inflicting upon people at home. Does it keep you awake at night?
Good questions on the review. Both the board and the staff welcome the review. It's an opportunity for us to hear from others. It's an opportunity to learn and to hear people's perspectives, and it's an opportunity for us to respond on some public policy issues as well. So I'm not worried that it's going to dig up anything. It's an opportunity to learn, and at the bank we've got a very strong learning mindset, and the fact that we're producing what I hope you view as an open review of the yield target this morning, we'll do further ones of these. So our mindset is to learn and to make sure that the monetary policy arrangements in Australia are serving us as we go forward. So we welcome it, and we're working constructively with the we will work constructively with the government on it. At a personal level, I'm proud in a way that the country has got to close to full employment. You know, the unemployment rate is the lowest in 50 years, and I said a higher share of the population have a job than ever before, and having a job is the best thing for people. It gets them, even young people, gets them on the ladder of opportunity, and once you're on that ladder, you can take further steps. So I take pride in the fact that the bank has worked with the government to get the unemployment rate as low as it was. I know businesses kind of don't always walk on that because it's harder to get workers, but for the overall welfare of the society, people having jobs is tremendously important. As interest rates go up, you know, some people are not going to be happy about that, and I know, but I know other people will be happy. Because the nearly 6 years I've been the governor, I've seen so many letters from people complaining that low interest rates are making their life a misery. So there is a segment, in fact a sizable segment of the population, who have been hurt by low interest rates. So our job is to kind of balance the people who don't like low interest rates with the people who want low interest rates. And as an individual, I'm concerned about the people who borrow too much and who could get themselves into trouble. So a constant messaging right through the last few years is make sure you have buffers. Be prepared. The future's uncertain. So some people will have problems, and as an individual, you know, that saddens me. But I take pride in the fact that this country is closer to full employment than it's been in 50 years, and that's important.
I think you sleep as well as anybody else in the room may or may not. Okay, Governor, let's go to a question that's come in online. This is from John Keir from the Australian Financial Review, asking, what impact do you think that the minimum and award rate wage rises that came through last week from the Fair Work Commission for the $2.7 million workers will have on wage and inflation psychology? Is there a risk, he asks, that we return to the 1970s?
Well, I certainly hope not, and I don't want to comment on that particular judgment. Just to refer to a medium-term point that I've been making for some years, and I think it remains relevant. And over time, we want to deliver you an average rate of inflation of 2.5%. If the country can generate wage labour productivity growth of 1%, hope we can do at least that, but if we can generate labour productivity growth of 1%, then that means labour costs in the steady state could grow at 3.5%. 2.5% for inflation and 1% for labour productivity growth. And I'd been concerned for a number of years that the rate of wage growth we had previously in the 2% to 2.5% range was too low. It was meaning that it was going to be hard for us to achieve the inflation target, and it was diminishing the society's sense of collective prosperity. So I've been speaking about that quite a lot. Just think it's important to remember that the steady state wage increases in Australia should be around 3.5%. We can have increases in some parts of the labour market bigger than that for a short period of time, but if wage increases become common in the 4 and 5% range, then inflation, it's going to be harder to return inflation to 2.5%. And there we're in a world where the economy will have to slow more and perhaps unemployment rate would need to raise. So I think people, if they can keep in mind that the steady state wage increases in this country, it's good to start with a 3. I was complaining when they started with a 2. I hope I don't get into an environment where I'm complaining that they kind of have a 5 in front of them. But, you know, 3.5 is kind of the anchoring point that, you know, I want people to keep in mind, and I know it's difficult when inflation's higher than that, but in the 70s we got into trouble, because wages growth responded mechanically to the higher inflation rate. We had higher inflation, wages responded, and then that becomes persistent, and then you have to have higher interest rates in the downturn to get inflation down. I'm hopeful we can avoid that, but it's an important issue. 3.5 is better than 2 and better than 5.
Perhaps we'll go to the back of the room first.
Good morning, Governor. Lewis Jackson from Morningstar. I'd like to ask you about how you think about the risks of over-tightening. You know, we've seen markets get quite jittery about growth over the last few weeks. The Federal Reserve last week cut their employment and growth forecasts. How do you think about the risk that that could happen here?
We're really asking whether we kind of make a kind of the risk of a policy mistake, and I'll let other people kind of opine on that. But it's a fairly narrow path, partly because of the uncertainty about the external environment, as I was saying in response to the question about kind of the international discussions. There are two quite plausible scenarios out there about how the inflation outlook evolves. You know, will the cuts in people's real incomes cut their spending and lead to a slowing in the economy and a rise in unemployment? That's possible. I think it's not particularly likely, but it's possible. But it's also possible that inflation comes down for the reasons I talked about, and we can keep this very low level of unemployment. So when there's all these uncertainties, it's highly unlikely that we'll get it exactly right. We'll make mistakes. I hope the mistakes are not too large and we kind of can self-correct. So probably the last point to make here is because of all this uncertainty, we're monitoring things incredibly carefully, including spending patterns and how people are going with mortgage, the rate of mortgage payments. And at the moment, the number of people who are falling behind on their mortgages is declining. And it's still fairly low, and it's much lower than many other countries. So, you know, there are a lot of moving parts, and when there are a lot of moving parts, you're not going to get it exactly right, but the Reserve Bank Board meets every single month, and we self-correct, hopefully, when things turn out differently, as we've done during the pandemic.
Sarah, I think you had another question.
Thank you, and thank you for letting me have a second question. I wanted to pick up a bit, actually, on the question from John Kehoe around inflation expectations. And you mentioned in a response to an earlier question about you think inflation is going to be above 3% for a number of years, a couple of years, I think you said. How do you see that then feeding through into inflation expectations? And are you worried about them becoming anchored at a higher level, to your point on wanting wages growth to be 3.5, not leading with a 4 or a 5?
Am I worried about it? If inflation expectations did start moving away from the 2 to 3% range, I would be very worried about that because the way to get them back to the 2 to 3% range would be a slower economy and you know, even slower wage growth and to bring inflation down. So if the inflation psychology shifts and people start expecting inflation rates in the 3s and 4s and higher, then we'll have problems. I'm not particularly worried about that happening at the moment. Inflation expectations, at least measured in financial markets, are still well anchored in the 2 to 3% range. I hope most people understand this is a spike in inflation due to COVID, largely due to COVID and the terrible events in Ukraine and the insurance that was taken out during the pandemic. The insurance is being unwound. The COVID supply problems are being fixed up, and who knows what's going to happen in Europe. But people should have confidence that inflation will come down again. And financial markets have that confidence, and I hope Australians have that confidence as well. If that confidence were to slip and the whole inflation psychology were to move up, then we'll have problems. So we'd best avoid that. And the higher interest rates, while they're uncomfortable for many people, are part of that. Of sending a strong message that inflation will come back down, we will do what's necessary. We're not going to let inflation persist at these very high rates.
Sophia Rodriguez from Central Bank Intel. You say in your speech that higher interest rates have a role to play by helping ensure that spending grows broadly in line with capacity to produce goods and services. How does that actually work? As in, because you said earlier that unemployment rate doesn't necessarily have to go up. So if spending has to slow, how can it slow and unemployment rate not go up?
Well, the rate of spending growth over the last 6 months has been strong enough to get the unemployment rate to come down a long way, hasn't it? We're at 4.9%, and the number of job ads at the moment is extraordinarily high. So the demand in the economy at the moment, the way that it's been growing, has been strong enough to get unemployment down. So it's quite possible to have slower growth in demand and growth in demand for labour matching growth in labour supply. But I acknowledge that there are risks that the balance here doesn't turn out to be in perfect balance. But it's certainly technically possible to have higher interest rates, slow spending, and spending slow to a point where growth in labour demand matches growth in labour supply.
There's
a lot of uncertainties there, but it's possible.
Well, we live in a world of possibilities. Yeah. Governor, you mentioned you expect to see a slowdown in spending. This is from Shane Wright. As interest rates increase, which areas of spending do you believe will be affected first or perhaps the most?
Well, the most interest-sensitive parts of spending are spending on housing. So housing construction is quite sensitive to the interest rate cycle. And spending on consumer durables is also typically quite sensitive to the interest rate cycle. It's complicated at the moment because over the past 2 years, people have bought a lot more stuff for the house. People were sitting at home kind of wanting to fit out their home office and kind of decorate their home. So there's been a lot of spending on consumer durables. So that's the other complication at the moment, that there could be some recalibration there at the time of higher interest rates. But historically, it's housing spending and spending on consumer durables. So we're watching those very carefully.
We're almost out of time. Is there another question from the room?
Thanks, Governor Lowe. Just picking up on your comment on full employment, that we're nearly, nearly at full employment, and you're not expecting unemployment rate to rise as interest rates move up. Given a range of indicators, whether it's, you know, the unemployment rate, the underemployment rate, the inflation pulse, survey data on availability of labour might suggest that we're beyond full employment. And I would interpret financial market pricing of a cash rate of 4 suggesting we're beyond full employment, and that's why rates have to move up. What's driving your assessment that we're not quite there, we're around full employment rather than beyond it, and what are the risks that we have gone beyond it, we push too hard and have to catch up?
Well, it's a good question, and there's quite a degree of uncertainty around what constitutes full employment in our economy, and it may be the case that we've gone further than is sustainably achievable. But I am conscious at the moment that the labour market has been in a sense of dislocation because many people have not been able to work. I know even my own organisation, a lot of people can't come to work because they're COVID, they've got COVID, or they're looking after a family member who's got COVID. So the labour market's been in a state of dislocation because of COVID. And that leads to very strong demand for workers, because if you can't, 5% or 10% of your workforce is away, you need extra workers, and so there's extra demand. So I don't think we'll know what full employment looks like until we're through the kind of COVID-related absences. It's very disruptive for many businesses, and it's led to shortages in parts of the economy, and we won't know what full employment looks like until after that's behind us. It's possible we've gone too far, but I'm hopeful that we can, in Australia, sustain an unemployment rate around 4%, have inflation of 2.5%, 1% labour productivity growth, and 3.5% on wages. That would be a good outcome, wouldn't it?
With 1 minute left, I will be cheeky and ask you one final question. Thank you for all the questions from the room and online. Dr. Lo, your business, the business liaison program provides a wealth of information. You know, and oftentimes we live for long periods between getting official data. Is there any consideration given to sharing more openly and transparently the information that comes from that liaison program on a regular basis?
We do share it on a regular basis in the quarterly statement on monetary policy. So each time that comes out, the next one will be in August, we highlight the key themes from that. So that's what we currently do. And sometimes, as occurred last month, we highlighted in speeches or press conferences that I give. So I'm not sure exactly what more we can put out on Business Liaison, but if people have good ideas, we're open to them. You know, at the moment, the model is to talk about it in the Statement of Monetary Policy each 3 months.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll shuffle you off. I'll close. I'll just finish very quickly. We came together today under the auspices of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia. Thank you, Doug, for the partnership to listen to Governor Philip Lowe discuss inflation and monetary policy, and also reference today's transparent review of the yield target. And thank you for the generosity with your time and openness in the Q&A. Maybe for me, the key takeaway is the RBA recognises the inflation challenges that I think we all see in our personal and professional lives. 7% inflation in the December quarter, a number you've mentioned publicly recently and repeated again today. Inflation is damaging to the economy and is regressive, so we do need to return it to target, but it doesn't need to happen tomorrow. There's a strong commitment to return it to target, and for that to happen, spending will need to slow. So I think the implications for interest rates are very clear. And look, I just a message to you, Governor, and your team at the RBA, a very challenging time, a word you've used quite often with lots of forces operating as you work extremely hard in the public eye to deliver into your mandates. And we do wish you all the best of health as you go about this important work. Thank you. Thank you, everybody.